Hello, listeners. This is Politico's Nerdcast. I'm Emily Stevenson, sitting in for Scott Bland. This week, how the Trump administration favored Texas over Puerto Rico after both places were hit with hurricanes last year, the results of a Politico investigation. Plus, we wrap up what was kind of a quiet week at the White House, just one firing. A reminder to our listeners to subscribe to the Nerdcast, rate us, and write a review. Helps new people find the show. And stay tuned for the end of the show for a special listener contribution. One more note before we begin. We're taping this a little bit before noon Eastern on Thursday, March 29th, so it's all up to date as of then. Okay, let's get started. I want to welcome our guests. We've got a member of the Politico White House team to help us get started. Nancy Cook, thanks for being here as always.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And Danny Vinnick, assistant editor of The Agenda and a first-time Nerdcaster.
Thanks for having me as well.
Thanks for being here. Time for our first data point, 10 days. It took FEMA just 10 days to approve permanent disaster work in Texas after Hurricane Harvey last year. Compare that to 43 days for the same declaration in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria. It's one of many disparities in how the federal government treated Texas and Puerto Rico after hurricanes struck last August and September. Danny, you reported this story this week. So start us off by reminding us about when the hurricanes hit, how serious they were, et cetera. This was about 6 months ago. Feels like 6 years ago. Remind us what happened.
Yeah, so Hurricane Harvey struck the Houston region on August 25th. A little less than a month later, Hurricane Maria struck Puerto Rico. And in some ways, they were very different storms. Hurricane Harvey kind of stayed above Houston, moved very slowly, dumped a ton of rain on the area. There was mass flooding, and it was, you know, a really tragic and gigantic event. And then on September 20th, when Hurricane Maria struck Puerto Rico, it moved a little bit quicker, but it took out basically the entire island's infrastructure, from roads, bridges, the electricity and communication systems, basically incapacitating the island itself. And so while they are both hurricanes, they both struck in very different ways. And given the island's financial and geographic situation, they had very different effects on the both locations.
Okay, so two different storms, also two very different responses from the federal government. So talk us through some of what you found when you compared how FEMA handled Harvey versus Maria.
We looked at a few different statistics to try to get some sort of a comparison. And one thing disaster recovery experts will tell you is that every disaster is different and no statistic is perfectly comparable. But we wanted to look at a bunch of different metrics to try to get some sort of an idea of how the response looked in each case. And what we found across the board was that there was a stronger and quicker response, particularly in the first few weeks in Houston than in Puerto Rico, whether you looked at food and water delivered, whether you looked at personnel on the ground, helicopters in use. Across the board, it was just a faster and stronger response in Houston.
So what are the specific criticisms that people have leveled at the federal government response in Puerto Rico?
There are a few different ones. One is food and water delivered slowly. I talked to one mayor who said in the first few weeks there was almost no support from FEMA during that time, and that he had to rely on nonprofits and local private sector organizations to help just feed his people. There's one story from another Puerto Rican mayor, which I didn't include in the piece, which she says that in the first, I think it was about 2 weeks after the storm, she got a shipment of food, and it contained just condiments, you know, hot sauce, ketchup, mayonnaise, and it was striking that that could happen. And, you know, it wasn't clear if FEMA had sent the food, if it was a nonprofit organization, but it spoke to some of the confusion and complexity in these responses. And it was a lot of the challenges, it was emblematic of a lot of the challenges that existed in the days and weeks after the storm. There were also a lot of concern about helicopters. FEMA, DOD put about a few dozen helicopters into play in Puerto Rico afterwards, which were critical for getting these supplies out there, which is one of the reasons they were slow to get out there. After Harvey, they had 70 plus within a few days buzzing around there, helping with flood water as, you know, rescues. And so, you know, these were some of the big challenges and criticisms that Puerto Rican officials had, that they just needed more support and it wasn't coming.
How did you do this reporting? Where did you get the data to do those comparisons?
We looked at a few different sources. First, we started by compiling basically every press release and, you know, public statement from officials and put it into a large spreadsheet and, you know, tried to take some sort of a snapshot look at what we had to begin with. And then we started going to the agencies themselves, asking for data on certain days that we could compare. And I was lucky to come across some documents from some sources that were able to provide more information that was comparable across the two disasters.
So how much of the difference in the federal government response can you chalk up to Texas is a state, Puerto Rico is a territory of the U.S., Texas is on the mainland, Puerto Rico is an island, there are actually legal restrictions for some shipping to Puerto Rico. Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens, but how much do the geographic differences explain the difference in the response?
I mean, the geographic differences are huge. And if you talk to FEMA officials, they will say that any sort of discrepancy in statistics is a result of the geography, it was a result of the infrastructure issues that were already existing on the island, it was a result of the fact that Hurricane Maria was the third of three major hurricanes to strike the United States just within a month. We forget Hurricane Irma was between Maria and Harvey. It struck both the U.S. Virgin Islands, swiped Puerto Rico, and then hit Florida as well. And so FEMA was stretched very, very thin. What they will tell you is that any sort of discrepancy is a result of that, you know, those inherent differences between the locations. But outside of FEMA, people on the ground, Puerto Rican personnel, you know, they still say that the prepositioning of assets, the use of federal resources just wasn't enough, and that there was both an underestimation of the storm and just it wasn't enough planning ahead for Hurricane Maria.
Let's zoom out a little bit and talk about the White House response, too. And Nancy, feel free to jump in if you have thoughts here. Danny, you wrote that President Trump's Twitter feed functions almost as a proxy for his attention on a daily basis. And that gave us some insight into how the federal government was responding to these two storms. So talk about what you meant when you wrote that.
It's a funny metric, and it's something we've never had before in a previous presidency. But in many ways, Trump's Twitter account is some sort of a window into what he's focusing on, what's capturing his attention. And in this case, when we looked after Harvey, there was 24 tweets within a week about the storm, praising first responders, saying we're going to get help down there, you know, applauding the response. Within a week after Hurricane Maria, there were only 8 tweets, and some of them were actually very critical of the island, of the island's infrastructure, its financial situation. You might remember he got into a fight with the San Juan mayor just a few days after the storm as well that captured news. And, you know, that breaks kind of one of the number one rules of emergency management, which is you don't attack the victims. And, you know, we use this to kind of show how the response from the highest reaches of the White House, you know, was more focused and more prioritizing the hurricane after Harvey than Maria.
Did Trump even go to Puerto Rico? Has he even been there?
He did 13 days after the storm.
It was a great trip and a beautiful place. I've been to Puerto Rico many times, as I think most of you have known, and I've always loved it. And your weather is second to none, but every once in a while you get hit. And you really got hit. There's no question about it.
Which was a lot longer it took him to get there than in Texas. He went twice, actually, within the first 8 days after Hurricane Harvey.
Wasn't that where he shot the three-pointer with the roll of toilet paper or something?
Yeah.
Paper towel?
When I was there, I mean, I was told by people that they found that kind of insulting. And, you know, it was almost making light of it, making a game. He praised the response down there, even as a lot of officials on the ground were, like, crying out for more help. And one of the actual things I was told, too, is that when he visited, it was a very stage-managed event, as presidential events are. But in this case, it was stage-managed that he could go to areas that were not hit that hard, that had concrete houses that were still standing. They might not have had electricity, but it was, you know, areas that looked pretty good. And it made him think that the recovery might have been better than it actually was.
And I think just after the hurricane in Texas, I think the White House was quite eager to get there. I mean, I remember talking to officials and, you know, they really wanted to put Trump on the ground there without sort of interfering with the disaster recovery relief. But there was real desire to put him there. I don't know if there was the same desire to necessarily send him to Puerto Rico as quickly in the aftermath.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure on that as well. I know when I talked to White House officials, they said that they had the same sort of inclinations, that they didn't want to get in way of the response. And given some of the issues on the ground, that it wasn't, you know, doable in the first week as it was with Harvey. At the same time, when I talked to, you know, residents in the area, they said he could have gone one or two streets over and seen much, much worse conditions afterwards. And it wouldn't have required him to go out, you know, much more central of the island where there might have been really ongoing survivor help on the way. He could have just, you know, walked two blocks over and seen much more degradation.
I think one thing that's been interesting just about the presidency in general is I think the president responds much more and much more favorably to sort of states or territories or people that have supported him. And we've seen that a bunch of different instances. I mean, the president just went to California, which is, you know, a huge state, I think 20% of the country's economy. He just went there recently, you know, almost a whole year after being elected. We saw that with the tax bill, for instance. You know, blue states got a much worse deal in terms of, you know, how their tax bill changed than red states. And it's just interesting to me that this hurricane response sort of happened in arguably the same way, where, you know, Trump is picking fights with the San Juan mayor. Puerto Rico is a more Democratic territory, whereas Texas, which has typically been more of a red state, you know, there was much more of a at least public response.
So how much do you feel like that played into the response versus were there other things that were occupying the White House's attention at that time?
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing explicit that, you know, we want to have a worse response to Puerto Rico for political reasons. I think it was lurking beneath the surface that a lot of people down there were concerned that that might have been a reason. But, you know, in the week after Hurricane Maria struck Puerto Rico, one of the things that the president spent a lot of time tweeting about and talking about was the NFL players and taking a knee during the national anthem. I mean, that dominated his Twitter feed. He sent, you know, two or three times as many tweets about that as about Hurricane Maria. And, you know, that also attracted national attention at the time, distracted away from the recovery efforts in Puerto Rico. And that sort of message can, you know, really have an effect on the bureaucracy in terms of sending a priority of what really matters at the upper reaches of the administration.
I mean, you were in Puerto Rico, Danny, and you saw this. Like, how did people in Puerto Rico feel about the response, particularly since a huge portion of the island is still without power? Isn't that right?
Yeah, I mean, roughly 5 to 10% still remains without power more than 6 months after the storm, which is kind of mind-boggling.
It's really shocking.
It is, and they're at the point now where some of the electricity poles they're fixing, they have to do all by helicopter, and so it is really hard. But they're, you know, the U.S. Army Corps had a ton of issues with it, and they've made promises that, you know, keep going by the wayside as the delays continue to pile up. It's very frustrating, I think, for a lot of people on the island. And in talking to mayors and other officials down there, they're careful not to criticize Puerto Rico, criticize FEMA and the administration's response. Right now, the administration has a lot of power over FEMA, over Puerto Rico. They, you know, have the money to dole out, and you don't want to anger the people who are going to be giving out that money. And so they're very careful with their words. They're very careful not to insult and you know, anger FEMA officials. But lurking beneath that, you can sense that they're pretty annoyed.
You wrote, too, in the story that so far no federal money had gone to permanent repair projects in Puerto Rico. How is that possible 6 months after the storm?
Yeah, there are kind of two main funding sources for public infrastructure after a storm like this. One is kind of the emergency, get the money there immediately, reimburse people for fixing, like, you know, emergency repairs. In this case, a lot of the electricity system was under the emergency category, communication systems, some roads and bridges. And then there's kind of the permanent side of it, where we're not just like patching things up to get it going in like the first few weeks, but we're going to try to rethink and, you know, think smarter going forward. And Puerto Rico hasn't gotten any money for that so far. And that's a result of the White House effectively forcing them to use this kind of new funding formula that will make them a guinea pig for this promising idea, but it hasn't been tried on this scale. And the idea is that you're going to give them this block grant of money to rebuild. And for Puerto Rico, which has, you know, an aging infrastructure system across the board, this block grant can really help them rethink, reimagine, and better rebuild for the future. At the same time, they're going to be responsible for any cost overruns, which for an island $70-plus billion in debt can be a huge deal. And it's not something that is faced for other places like Houston or Florida or even the U.S. Virgin Islands.
So anything else you noticed when you were there recently? Any other takeaways or just things that you saw that you think people ought to know about?
You know, one of the things that always struck me when I was driving around and visiting different parts of the island is that the stoplights are out in a lot of places still. And I was just there a few weeks ago, even in parts of San Juan. It's a bit of a free-for-all on the roads, which is, you know, one slows down everything, creates new hassles. There's an economic cost there, and it's dangerous. And, you know, it's been 6 months now, and the power is still not on throughout the entire island. And, you know, people are struggling to just navigate roadways. And so, you know, we still have a long way to go.
Yeah. Well, Danny, thank you so much for coming on. This was great.
Thanks for having me.
Nancy, you're going to stick around for our next segment?
I'm here.
All right. On to our second data point, 3. That is the number of presidents that Dr. Ronny Jackson has served as the White House physician, and now he's the president's pick to run Veterans Affairs. We're going to recap that, plus what else was happening at the White House this week with Nancy, who's still with us, and Andrew Rastuccia, who's joining us, another White House reporter. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So a lot of top people at the White House have resigned or been fired in the last month. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster, top economic advisor Gary Cohen, now the VA secretary. Did this latest one catch anybody off guard?
I would say no. I mean, there's been for weeks now a pretty steady drumbeat that Shulkin is gone. White House, top White House aides really couldn't hide their disdain for him, even in some public ways. A long time ago, they stopped basically denying the notion that he was going to be, that he was at least on thin ice with the president. I wouldn't say this one was a surprise. It was really more of a matter of exactly when it might happen. And we had reported a few weeks ago that it was potentially going to happen after an inspector general report was released. But clearly, Trump wanted to move pretty quickly.
Yeah, so what caused that friction? Why was the previous VA secretary, David Shulkin, at such odds with the White House?
Well, there were a couple things. There were reports that he had taken a trip to Europe, there were some questions in terms of the ethics of going to the Wimbledon tennis tournament while he was there with his wife. And then there was also just some sort of personnel friction there. There was a belief in the White House that Shulkin, and he has since confirmed this, was very much opposed to privatizing veterans' health care. He believes it would lead to the collapse of the system, the VA system as it exists right now. And then also people in the White House just didn't really like him. I mean, there was a point where he, in an interview with Politico, actually said that he had the White House's blessing to purge people within his own administration, his own department, that were working against him. And the White House has since said privately to me and others at Politico that there was no such conversation. He had no such authority. And so that has led to a lot of bad blood. That has been, and this whole thing has been simmering for several weeks, and it really came to a head.
That moment when he said that he had the White House's backing when he didn't seems to be kind of the point where they said, we've had enough.
Yeah,
right?
At least for senior staff in the White House, that was really the point where they felt, okay, like this guy just doesn't have our trust anymore.
I do think the Inspector General report, too, sort of put him on thin ice because, you know, there have been a bunch of cabinet secretaries who have been put in the spotlight for using taxpayer dollars in ways that the White House that has embarrassed the White House, that the White House has not been super psyched about. And so these questions about, you know, who paid for the Europe trip and, you know, did Shulkin accept these Wimbledon tickets and was that acceptable? You know, this is sort of a broader conversation that also involves Ben Carson, Ryan Zinke of the Interior, Scott Pruitt, who's taking all these flights back home to Oklahoma. These are just like a bunch of questions about how taxpayer dollars are being spent. And the White House doesn't like it. They feel like it's something that should be avoided.
And on some level, he was sort of the sacrificial lamb for all of this, all these questions about spending and travel. But I do think if it was just the IG report and there was nothing else, that he might be okay. There was this sense in the White House that like he was actively working against one of their priorities, which is sort of moving toward a more private system for healthcare. And you just kind of can't have that, right?
Well, and I think y'all reported at one point that he and Ben Carson were both sort of possibly the next on the chopping block. And this personnel stuff seems to have been what put Shulkin over the edge. And Ben Carson still seems to be okay for now.
For now, yeah. And we're hearing that Carson is for now going to be sticking around. I mean, although, you know, anything's possible with this president. But I hate to make these sort of predictions and then tomorrow he sends out a tweet. But from what we know, Carson's pretty safe.
But I feel like if we wanted to like label a theme of this week, it really was like, when is Shulkin going to get fired? Not like if. And so, you know, I was talking to White House people on Monday, you know, Tuesday night, and it seemed quiet. You know, Trump hasn't made public appearances this week. You know, he went to a dinner out in McLean with, you know, some donors on Tuesday night, but he hasn't really made a lot of public appearances, although today he is going to Ohio. And so it's felt quiet. But as I've talked to people, people have said like, oh, you know, there's actually a ton of stuff happening beneath the surface and like this isn't going to last. And everyone I talked to was just basically on like Shulkin, when's he going to get fired watch and how's it going to happen?
So that part wasn't really a surprise, but it does seem like choosing Dr. Ronnie Jackson to be the replacement for David Shulkin was kind of a surprise pick. So what do we know so far about why Trump picked Dr. Ronnie, as they call him in the White House? And looking at the people that he's chosen lately to replace Tillerson and McMaster and Cohen, is there anything we can say about how Trump is deciding who he wants around him now?
Well, I think that a couple things. One, I think that he's basically, I think we should take this moment seriously because it's not really just like people coming and going. It's actually Trump fundamentally reshaping the cabinet in his second year. And that's a big deal. And that will be a big deal moving forward. But I think the people that he's picking share some characteristics. One, they're loyal to the president. Two, he has personal chemistry with them and has a good relationship with them. Some of the people he picked, he thinks they're good on TV. Like, he really liked that Dr. Ronnie, you know, went up in front of the White House press corps for, I think, almost an hour and took a ton of reporters' tough questions about the president's physical health. And the president thought that he did a good job with that.
And the president's mental health.
In summary, the president's overall health is excellent. His cardiac performance during his physical exam was very good. He continues to enjoy the significant long-term cardiac and overall health benefits that come from a lifetime of abstinence from tobacco and alcohol.
But, you know, Larry Kudlow, the new head of the NEC, it was the same thing. You know, he's a CNBC commentator. He's on TV all the time. You know, Trump liked that. And then other people, I just think, you know, John Bolton, for instance, like really reaffirms. You know, he has a mustache that everyone says Trump didn't like. That was like the big hurdle to overcome, this mustache. But he does have some sort of really hawkish policies on North Korea and the Iran deal that I think really speak to some of Trump's campaign promises and also just sort of how he viscerally feels about these things. And so those are the characteristics that I see sort of emerging from this kind of newish formation of the cabinet.
And I think you're going to run into a situation in the Senate where you're going to really potentially hit a brick wall with confirming some of these folks. You know, Dr. Ronnie, you know, for all of the reasons that Trump picked him, he does not have any experience running a bureaucracy. He has no he served three presidents as the White House physician, right? And that you know, is one qualification. But it's very different than running, which I think is the second biggest bureaucracy in the federal government. So there are going to be some real questions about him in the Senate, and there already are.
Well, and the people that I talked to were already sort of a bit worried about how it was going to go for the new CIA director and, you know, Mike Pompeo at State, who doesn't necessarily have those diplomatic qualifications. And as I was talking to people earlier this week, they were saying, you know, we don't need another like out of the box pick to try to get through a Senate confirmation. We already have these two battles in front of us. And the reaction on the Hill to Dr. Ronnie was pretty lukewarm yesterday. I mean, you didn't hear a lot of senators coming out and being like, great pick. You know, it was very muted.
Right. And Andrew, you wrote this morning that David Shulkin is not going down easy. And
yeah,
that can't help make this process easier for the White House.
Right. I mean, you know, Shulkin is within 12 hours or 18 hours of being summarily fired on Twitter, had published an op-ed in the New York Times in which he basically argued that there was a political motivation behind his firing and did an interview with NPR. That is very unusual. In previous administrations, you would never or at least rarely see a fired cabinet or a resigned cabinet member or even a senior member of the administration speak publicly in the hours or days or weeks even after they've been removed. I mean, maybe they would write a book later on or something like that. But I mean, this also just goes to show that, you know, Trump inspires loyalty within his deep core circle, but he also, his way of governing also repels a lot of people, even people in his sort of outer circle. And you can't expect that loyalty to last if you're publicly fired on Twitter.
Well, and I think one of the key lines of that Shulkin New York Times op-ed was that he wrote, "As I prepare to leave government, I am struck by a reoccurring thought, it should not be this hard to serve your country." Which I thought was...
That's a pretty powerful statement.
That's a very powerful statement, coming from someone who just, you know, was fired by tweet, you know, less than 24 hours
and
ago.
And he was the only holdover from the Obama administration. So there, I mean, at least in the cabinet.
I think that one of the ironic things for me is that President Trump has always, and, you know, the White House's top attorney thinks this way too, you know, there's a real paranoia about how the deep state is going to trip them up. And by the deep state, they're talking about, you know, career federal workers, you know, not political appointees who work in these agencies and they think aren't going to follow their agenda. But honestly, Trump has fired or pushed out or people have resigned so many people in this first year that those people, I think, represent their own sort of deep state, if we want to use that phrase, but just their own sort of cast of characters who really could hurt the Trump White House because they know so much, you know, even if they don't participate in like the Russia investigation stuff, you know, they're talking to the press, they're criticizing, and they know what they're talking about. They're speaking from a position of authority.
And they already are in some ways hurting this administration. I mean, it is not hard as reporters to call a former Trump administration official and get them to dish to you off the record or on background about, you know, the president's leadership style. And the things that they say are often not positive.
It's also, we've talked about this before, but nobody who leaves the Trump orbit is ever really gone. So you can call and talk to those people about current decisions he's making now.
Right. I mean, this is sort of tried at this point, but the people outside the building often know more than the people inside.
We talked on the way up, too, about how this Shulkin firing reminded us of the firings of Andy McCabe from the FBI and James Comey earlier from the FBI, where they sort of twisted in the wind for a while, knew they were going to get fired. And then when they did get fired, they had this media plan where they did op-eds or talked to reporters, or Comey's got a book coming out next month.
Right. And Politico published an interview with McCabe the day, like the moment he got fired, it was ready to go.
Right.
And Comey's coming out with a book, as you said, and he has his Twitter account, which is sort of, he's always sort of subtly jabbing the president and sometimes not so subtly jabbing the president.
So do you think we're going to be hearing more publicly from these people who feel like they were treated badly by the Trump administration?
I think so. I mean, what do they have to lose, really? I mean, at this point, Shulkin, you know, I mean, we shouldn't just pretend that Shulkin is some hero either, right? I mean, there are some issues there, but he can sort of recast himself as this sort of person that was unfairly removed, and, you know, he's going to probably win a lot of admirers doing that.
Yeah, I want to hear from Rex Tillerson and H.R. McMaster.
Right.
I want them
they
to
They notably have been silent.
They have been.
Those books.
Yeah, I want some dishing from them.
I could see like a 60 Minutes interview in like 6 months or so with Tillerson.
Yeah, I could too.
Yeah.
So y'all also wrote this week about the departure of someone I can't imagine is going to write a book, and that is Hope Hicks. This is her last week in the White House. Remind us why this is a big deal that Hope is leaving after 3 years with Donald Trump.
Well, I think so. Hope has been the communications director, but she's really been much, much more than that. She has been with Trump since 2015 throughout the campaign. She's kind of like, you know, his right hand person. She calms factions down in the White House. I think she keeps him calm and a little bit under control, and also sort of helps him keep track of things. And so it's not just like you're losing a communications director in charge of messaging. You're losing, honestly, I would argue, the president's most trusted advisor at this point. And I think that, you know, what we're going to see, it'll be interesting moving forward, because I think that it could potentially be a much more chaotic situation without, you know, her office is right outside the Oval. So without someone sort of that right-hand person there, I think it will be a little bit more chaotic. And keep in mind, you know, she's a trusted advisor, but Trump has also in the last 6 months lost a few other sort of key personal aides. Johnny McEntee, who was his body man, that's like the person that, you know, gives the president briefing books and sort of goes everywhere with him and gives him everything. Johnny McEntee got fired maybe 2 weeks ago. There were some concerns that he had a gambling problem and that would hurt security clearance. But the president loved him. You know, they talked football together. They blew off steam. That's a big loss. And then before Johnny, he lost Keith Schiller, who used to work for the Trump Organization and was also kind of like this security blanket, right-hand man sort of person. And so, you know, the president at this point doesn't have a ton of people who he feels really comfortable with, who he thinks are loyal, who have known him for a long time around him. And I think that that's just further isolates him.
So y'all had a line in a previous story that I really liked that I keep thinking about how losing Hope Hicks was more like losing a limb for Trump than just losing an aide. So talk about the difficulty of replacing her. Where are they looking and why are they having such a hard time finding someone?
Big picture, I think you're not seeing a huge amount of urgency from the president to find someone to stand in for Hope. I think that's partly because, you know, the president on some level is in a little bit of denial that he's losing her, right? I mean, like, he doesn't want her to go. Today, Thursday, when we're taping this, is technically her last day in the White House. But I think you're going to see this president repeatedly leaning on Hope, even from the outside.
And the thing is that the comm shop is a tough job in this White House. I mean, the president, you know, one former administration official told me it's basically, you know, second to the chief of staff in terms of the pressure and stress. So that it's like really elevated in this White House more so than it has been in others, just because Trump cares so much about messaging and branding. This White House has already been through 4 communications directors in 14 months. So that's a crazy turnover rate. And it's just, you know, you're really on the front lines of everything. And it's, you know, it's a hard job. I'm not sure that tons of people would want it.
Yeah, and imagine, like, you if you don't have that close relationship with the president like Hope does, you're going to constantly be caught off guard by every time he tweets that he's firing someone or, you know, says something outlandish in public. And it's basically an impossible job if you're not prepared for what he's going to do.
Well, that was my question, is we were just talking about how the president fired somebody by tweet last night. So is he listening to his communications staff at all right now?
The president doesn't take orders from his communications staff. I mean, that much is clear at this point.
So ultimately, nobody speaks for the president except for the president.
Exactly. And Sarah and others will tell you that.
So just to wrap things up and kick it forward a little bit, did this week, a week in which someone was fired by tweet, feel kind of weirdly quiet to you guys? You talked earlier about how, I think, Nancy, you said people in the White House told you that there were things going on behind the scenes that we're not seeing publicly. So what do you guys think is coming next? What is the White House's next big push or big effort, or what's been going on behind the scenes?
Well, I think one ongoing story will just be the way that Trump is reshaping the cabinet. I think that that's a really fascinating story, and how those people, you know, can they get confirmed through the Senate? Sort of how do they interact with, like, how does that reshape the vibe and the tone of the whole cabinet? And then I think one thing that we're all watching is what happens with General Kelly. I mean, I think that he's safe for now. But, you know, people I talked to this week said, you know, I think the president probably wants to get rid of him at some point. But the fact of the matter is, you have to find a replacement. And so I've been told that that's the case also with Don McGahn, the White House top attorney, who I think wants to leave on his own volition. But, like, who's, you know, what happens with Kelly? And then what happens with all these jobs? I mean, can they find people who want to come into the White House at this point?
And I think the other thing that I'm going to be looking at is the president's agenda heading into the midterms, and I think the lack of an agenda heading into the midterms. You've seen his biggest success is tax reform, and he doesn't actually talk about that very much, to much to the chagrin of top Republicans in Congress. So we have several more months until to the 2018 midterm elections, and what is he going to run on? What can he accomplish? Congress is not particularly capable of passing big legislation at this point. So what is his message going to be to the midterm electorate?
All right, we'll leave it there. Andrew, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Nancy, thanks for being on.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, as promised, something a little different this week. Since it's our 100th episode of Nerdcast, we asked a fan of the show to help us out with the credits. Patrick Graney Nolan of Chicago, take it away.
Nerdcast is produced by Bridget Mulcahy and Michaela Rodriguez, with help this week from Adrian Hurst. Dave Shaw is the executive producer, the Nerdcast researcher is Zach Montalaro, and their illustrator is Bill Cookman. If you like the Nerdcast and you're listening on Apple Podcasts, why not rate the show and leave a review? It helps new listeners find the show.
Thanks, Patrick. Listeners, we found Patrick because he sent us a tweet saying he was a fan. If you are a Nerdcast fan who wants to read the credits, let us know. Shoot an email to nerdcast@politico.com. Thanks. We'll talk next week.